Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
I'm George Chen, and this is SupDoc, where we discuss and dissect documentaries chosen by our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, TV, and more. Today, we're talking the new 6-part Netflix docuseries Wild Wild Country about the Rajneesh movement that came to rural Oregon in the 1980s.
Was this a clash of worldly orange-clad hippies and conservative townspeople, or a mafia-style hostile takeover? The directors McLean and Chapman Way have crafted a twisting drama with unearthed tape of the Rajneesh Purim saga, plus new interviews with all the key players.
And to help us sort through it, our guest is Richard Parks III. A journalist, podcaster, multi-hyphenate Los Angeles native, Richard has written for Lucky Peach, The New York Times, and McSweeney's, and has contributed to Snap Judgment and KCRW's Lost Notes.
If you haven't finished Wild Wild Country, we do talk about the whole thing, so spoilers.
If you haven't started at all, get on top of it. This is the thing to talk about. This is like the water cooler documentary series of the season.
But you can enjoy this conversation even if you haven't watched the series. There is so much to process, so much to talk about, so let's get into it now. Here's Richard Parks.
I wrote a couple things down.
Okay.
I don't know. A couple things that well, you know, we could talk about, this is such a long, first of all, it's a 6-hour series, so it's kind of like a big assignment.
Yeah. We gave you homework for this.
You did.
We did.
And our truant student who's bringing in his homework, he's a dog ate his homework. It's Richard Parks, everyone.
Hello. How are you? I'm Richard Parks, the third.
Yeah.
I recently rebranded as Richard Parks III because as the person I wrote a cookbook with told me when we were discussing the author credit, you have to go with Richard Parks III because everybody's named Richard Parks.
Oh, yeah.
I thought your nickname was RP3.
That was his nickname for me. Yeah. Wesley Avila, the chef that I wrote a cookbook with. RP3, he likes to call me.
By the way, yes, you just brought over Paco. You may not know this, but Richard wrote a book about tacos. A specific chef, Wes Avila, who does gorilla tacos down here. And he just brought over, I am a happy recipient of one of a very limited edition of FlexiDisc postcards.
That's right. Just 1,000 made. Do you know about FlexiDiscs, Paco?
I don't. Fill me in.
The things that, I mean, they used to be common when record players were ubiquitous,
but often
in promotion of something, you would get it's like a little insert
in a magazine.
You'll see something perforated edge.
I loved those things when I was a kid.
So at some point in the 80s, McDonald's printed 80 million flexi discs in a sort of like golden ticket, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory contest.
Right.
One of the discs played a slightly different track than all the others and entitled the person who found this disc to $1 million.
Ooh. So I thought you were going to say it was backwards masking. Like it had actually your grimace is your god, you know. Do not eat your vegetables. I was going to say the FlexiDisc is also an infamous format in the noise and hardcore genres. And
you would probably know more about that.
Grindcore. Oh, it's a preferred format of grindcore. My favorite format of grindcore might be you take a FlexiDisc, but it's also split left-right channel. So to get the most amount of music, it's also like every song is 10 seconds. and then there's a different track in the left channel and in the right channel.
Wow.
So you have two, you can actually like make like, you know, 12 minutes of music on a flexi disc if you do it like that.
So they're really stretching the form.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also a terrible idea because they do not play very well after a while. So
I have a terrible idea that relates to that, which is to make a self-help audiobook, audio only. It's your false self on the left channel and your true self on the right channel, but they're both speaking at the same time. So if you were to put both earphones on, it would just be chaos.
Now, to give a little context, you do audio for a living, right?
These Richard? Days, this yeah. Is one of, technically, one of your things, right? I have a job. I have a job podcasting, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I asked you to come do this because I heard you talking about Wild Wild Country on your podcast.
My secret podcast.
Is that you're not promoting that one?
I mean,
is it just like if you find it, you find it. If you Google Richard Parks,
it's not for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
It's how would you describe this podcast, George?
Okay, so Paco. Would you want to hear Richard and a friend of his eating breakfast at the Astro Diner?
Yes.
And then just talking about whatever and like talking to the waitress?
Mm-hmm.
Like they do this every week. And you've been doing this since like last year?
We have like 23 episodes, but the number is a little misleading because for our 10th episode, I wanted to try something different. So I suggested doing 10 6-minute microsodes. All recorded at once instead of the usual hour that we do.
Oh.
And I think that
I didn't listen to
that.
That
had a disastrous result. Yeah, I'm glad you didn't. I don't think many people did. I think it drove our listenership way down into the double digits.
That is like the equivalent of like putting out a flexi disc for the podcast world, though. Like
we
you
did
just
it.
Broke it into like microsodes of the same meal.
We did it. Yeah. And actually, this week is the first week we just couldn't get it together this week. So
oh,
maybe it's finally
shit.
Falling apart. Yeah.
Well, we'll just put this one out. Just put
sure.
this one out
yeah,
early.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that would be that's announce. A fun idea. I think yeah. Yeah, we could
crossover.
Right
we got to do some more crossovers. But because you do audio, and you have a documentary journalism background,
right?
Right. So,
yes.
I just was curious what you thought of this doc. But I think when I asked you, you hadn't actually finished it yet.
I hadn't. No, I had to get through. I mean, it was a 6-part series. Like we said, it's not just a feature film. It's a whole series. So yeah, I got to the end, and I think so many things about it that it's hard to even know what to start with.
Dude, it's going to take 3 people to break down the 6 episodes of Wild Wild Country. Paco, this is what we're talking about, Wild Wild Country. Do you want to talk a little bit about... Did I make you watch it, or did you already want to watch it?
Is me? Is this to me?
Yeah, Paco, yeah.
Did you make me watch it?
Yeah, because I was like, we got to do an episode about this, and then like, I didn't think you'd seen it when I said... I think I was about like 4 episodes in when I was like,
oh,
we
I
have
see.
To do this one.
Yeah. Yes, you posted about it. And then I watched it.
Did you hear anything from anyone else about it? Had you talked to anyone about it yet?
No, neither. None of the above. No, I you said we should do this. And then I was like, George is rarely, rarely right. So let me check this out and see. And I was like, by golly, this is something.
It's not that I'm rarely right. I'm really enthusiastic about
that's
anything.
What it
that's
is.
It's really more of what it is. Well, it's like, why is he... It's like the last thing I tried to force us to do was this Russian road movie, which is just like dash cam footage.
Well, yes. I didn't know anything about this story before watching. I don't know if you guys did. And I think that's one of the things about it that make it so... the structure work all the better.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of people are coming to it fresh and... You have what you bring to it are some assumptions probably about how cults operate, the cult stories that you do know,
mm-hmm.
That are, you know, have a bigger place in the culture, I think help create the long stick, you know, at which, you know, at the end of which there's probably a carrot that kind of keeps you hooked and getting through a 6-part series of, you know, 6-hour-long segments as opposed to a feature length, which I think is one of the most interesting things about this is that mm-hmm. the series approach in the culture right now, I feel like it's like a new form, you know?
Right. Yeah. You had some thoughts about that. I mean, that is kind of like what's new about the Netflix, the streaming model, firstly, is very good for documentaries, right?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of documentaries have found another life via the streaming format, and then this multi-part series, and you said like it's also equivalent to what's happening in podcasting, right?
There's absolutely
like, sort of investigative podcast stuff, and also I think a good point being like I vaguely heard of the Bhagwan, and I kind of remembered the Rolls Royces, but I didn't really know any of these other details. So when you just are dumped into it, like, really, the first episode and a half are just set up, like introducing all these characters, right? So it's hard to think about. I think about it now as a whole, but I do remember, like, the first two or three, they have such cliffhangers, and they get you hooked in to keep doing it, because we had to just binge through. We got to, like, about three, and we're like, okay, we got to go to sleep, but then tomorrow morning we're going to get back
into
this.
Knock out the next three.
Yeah, and yeah, there was, like, so little I remembered about the actual thing, and they were sort of I felt sympathetic towards them in the beginning, and I feel like my sympathies sort of jump all over the place throughout this thing.
I think that's purposeful. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're doing. They put the hook, line, and sinker in the beginning so that you feel like, you know what? These guys, not so bad. That Sheila, she's a good chick. She's a good egg. She's got some good ideas. Things are gonna be all kinds of fine in Antelope, Oregon. And the thing is, like, it's very smart because they don't use talking heads. They don't talk to, like, criminal psychologists, and they don't talk to people who are, like, infiltrate cults. They let it unfold itself. And then after each episode, you are left wondering, do I believe these people or not? Like, who's guilty? Who's not? It's like Making a Murder. It has that same kind of feel. It's like, who do I believe? Who's right? Who's wrong? Let's watch episode two because I need to know more.
I actually thought it was very different than Making a Murderer, because in Making a Murderer, although it was presented with sort of the, you know, in the proscenium of an objective documentary approach, I felt like I was pretty clear about where the filmmakers came down. You know, I felt like I knew what their agenda was. In Making a Murderer. Whereas here, I mean, I think that I, to an extent, understand the filmmaker's intent.
Yeah.
But I don't think that... I think that they're probably grappling with the same things that we are, and that's what's good about it. And another thing about the long-form series approach is that you can kind of get ping-pong back and forth. I mean, that happens in the first episode. I think it's all... I want to watch it again because the structure is just so amazing. You know, it just, like, works so well. But, like, the first episode... We open the story by hearing from the town. Mm-hmm. It's these people showed up. What were they doing here? And immediately, I think in this cultural moment, you're thinking of, like, oh, these bigoted small town people. Because I think, you know, right now, 2018, we're in a very black and white world when it comes to, you know, city versus country, like America, quote unquote, American versus immigrant. When it comes to guns, you know, and sort of a lot of the taboos that come up in this series. But I think that it would be wrong to apply a 2018 like understanding of, you know, these characters. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the film does really well is it kind of like plays with that and subverts that, because if you had heard everything that Sheila had done right at the beginning,
yeah.
I mean, they tease it pretty heavily, but if you knew what she had done and been... although I don't know if she actually ever really cops to it, but you would say this is a sociopath and this is a crazy cult, but they don't bring her in that way. And the second part of the first episode is all about telling the story of the cult from their perspective, telling, you know, it gives you a lot from a lot of like, anecdotes about how people encountered, the leader, the Bhagwan, and like fell in love with him. You know, you sympathize with like, these are good folks just searching, and then they connected to the 60s very artfully. I think that with Sheila and with everybody in the film, what's interesting is that you probably just can't decide where you land with them. Like, is she a sociopath or is she just this super charming, smart lady who, you know, has a great head on her shoulders and should be empowered?
In the northern part of Oregon, there used to be a little town called Antelope. Yesterday, the voters in Antelope decided to change the town's name to Rajneesh. It is a political victory for followers of the Indian guru, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh.
Change has been coming, and today, Antelope awoke to a red dawn.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I've heard some chatter. I think I've seen a few things online about how, you know, it's the filmmakers are exposing kind of like bigotry in small town America. And I think that that's something that actually I don't think that they're intending to do. I think it's just a storytelling device, for example, for them to be surprised and sort of, you know, taken aback by the presence of this group in their town. And throughout it, I sympathize with the town as much as I do with the cult. What's interesting is that I think that the divide between the two groups basically comes down to more. It's more like a urban rural divide than it is anything else.
That's interesting
because I mean the voices that you hear in the film are mostly white people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's educated, like urban kind of liberal. White people with a lot of money and good jobs. That's who you see in the film, basically representing the cult.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like poor country folk who are all white as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's Sheila, who is of Indian extraction, mm-hmm. obviously. But other than that, I mean, those are the voices that the filmmakers chose to include. So the dichotomy, I think, is much more similar to like a 2018 like city versus country than not.
The one pushback I would have on that is how like a lot of the anti-Bhagwan stuff did feel super racist.
It did.
So it's like it maybe you could try to like dig back and be like in their minds like, well, it's more like these fucking freaks in orange than it was like that they're from India. But right. It felt like because part of the whole thing was about immigration law and trying to get them out on, I think, like a tax fraud and immigration law was right. Like the real approach to it all. I in the first two, I felt like. Yeah, this is like I've been in Oregon in the 80s. I remember being like this is like the whitest place I've ever been.
Right.
So I had that feeling a little bit. But then, yeah, as it goes on, it's not like I don't know that I sympathize with their. I mean, I definitely feel like they're small minded, but also I'm like, I don't want to get poisoned, you know, when I'm just trying to go eat at Sizzler.
Right. I think that it was wrong of Sheila to poison.
I'm going
to
take a strong stand on anti-botulism right now, what was it? They blended up some beavers. That was the other. They tried
the
to turn
beavers,
make a blended beaver poison. That was like already like that was like episode three or something.
Because the whole beavers weren't like osmoting into the water quick enough or whatever.
Yeah, it's just like to create like a like the ring or whatever, like a poison well. I mean, also I've also heard that vanilla has to do with beavers. Like vanilla is extracted from beavers. Is this folklore? You're the food guy. I feel like you would have heard something about this.
I have never heard that.
Okay, well, let's.
And the biggest story when I was the community newspaper editor of the Martinez News Gazette was the appearance of a beaver family in the downtown creek. The concerns over flooding that this human interest story created. But so Sheila, I think that it was wrong of her to poison people, you know, like
we're anti-poison here.
But it, like this film is kind of her story too. And then you think like, you know, like she describes meeting this guy. I think she was 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so basically she's on board from that moment on. She's given an immense amount of power. It's always unclear to what extent the Bhagwan was calling the shots on this stuff about like poisoning and even, you know, just the what they ended up busting him on, which was the illegal marriages, you know, mm-hmm. the stuff that like doesn't even seem like that big a deal. But was that all kind of coming from Sheila, you know, who was also doing the wiretapping? Mm-hmm. But then like how much did this group and this leader enable, you know, Sheila to come to that point of power or like, you know, how influential was she? She doesn't come across like it, but when she was 16 or whatever and mm-hmm. she joined this cult, you know, it's just she's just so darn smart and charming, and I mean to me she's way more charismatic in the film than Osho is.
Oh,
even.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right. She is the subject of this documentary, and I think that you know, after watching all six, you do come away with a feeling of she was empowered. She was in power. She tried to murder some people. She tried to bio-attack them. She brought in thousands of homeless people and then had them sedated. Like, this woman is not above reproach. Like, she's I feel like, guilty. And I think the filmmakers, there is a slant there, because maybe it's just the facts. But after watching it, you do feel like, you know, she's and she actually pled guilty as well. But I don't think I don't think there's too much confusion that she's guilty.
Well, like, she's guilty, but is she guilty? You know, that's, I guess, where I'm wondering. Does she feel guilty? Right.
Oh, well,
doesn't seem like she does.
No, she seems like a sociopath to me. I don't think she feels guilty at all. I think she feels like she was doing what was necessary to protect Osho, the commune, their brand, her lifestyle, which seemed to be lavish as well. I mean, like, these kind of people, I have zero sympathy for her or any of the people that are the upper echelon of this cult, because it's like, this is so manipulative and purposeful in a way to maintain power and wealth that it's like, I wish she was still in prison personally. I have zero sympathy for Sheila, and I can't, it's crazy that she was only sentenced. I think she was sentenced to 20 years, but only served two. And then she got out and then got to leave the country and now lives in Switzerland or whatever. Like, after watching,
nobody died. Nobody died.
Like, there was attempted murder.
Yeah, there was one attempted murder.
Well, the poisoning and of 700 people.
But to hear Sheila tell it about the attempted murder, she was actually protecting Bhagwan from his own personal doctor who was giving him these drugs, and she didn't agree with that. And like, hear her tell it, like, she had made an ethical choice in basically ordering this murder, it seems, that she feels completely justified and satisfied with to this day. Like, she doesn't speak with any remorse.
There's no such thing as an ethical choice of murder.
Well, murder, I think, is more of a moral issue than an ethical one, generally. I think there's a book about that, I think.
I think, like, yeah, she's an anti-hero. That's what I kind of like about this, right? She is like a Walter White. You, like, see her go to these extremes to protect what she loves, and then, like, to the point where she destroys it. But I do want to say, the only thing I will say, it's suspicious. You guys want to answer a trivia question? How old was the Osho when he died?
63.
Take a guess. You saw his face. How old would you guess that dude was?
Oh, just visually, is in his 70s at least. Probably
58.
58. Wow,
dude was 58.
Yeah, and
or maybe she was onto something. Maybe his doctors were sneaking him a lot of weird stuff. Like, that's another possibility.
They made
him
age that quickly.
Yeah. I mean, like, what's his whole thing? He won't talk for like what, 2 years or something. And won't publicly talk.
Yeah, the morphine feels too good.
Yeah.
Reason to say anything.
I thought it was, not proven. I thought it was like well known that he was on drugs.
I think in the later episodes, she's talking about how she disagreed with whatever medication he was on. And that was part of the story of her eventually leaving and splintering off. I think it was connected to the attempted murder in one way, but I think they also connected it to her disagreement with the doctor who was giving him the drugs.
Mm-hmm. Swami Amrito, aka George Meredith. Everyone has like three names in this, by the way. You're gonna lose track unless you have like a visual. That was a guy who, like, I think could have been like in Lord of the Rings, basically, the doctor. Yeah. He looked like
dude
who fights,
or any of the Harry Potter movies. But we cannot forget the plotting of the murder of the United States attorney, though. I mean, we're talking about the doctor, but Sheila and her cohorts also tried to kill the United States attorney. Because he was investigating them. I mean, like, this does not sound like a person who's like, oh, my family's going to get hurt. I need to, like, get rid of this evil doctor. This is someone who's like, they're going to take away my fucking hot tub, and I can't have that. I need to kill this fucking attorney.
I got to say, like, this speaks to how well done this documentary is that I usually...
Good point.
Like, I never tend to side with the cult. Like, that's like exactly. It's my default. Like, I watch Going Clear. I'm like, these people I've done all this stuff. And then for to a degree in this, I'm just like, they just want to wear red and hang out and some vegan food, which they don't even like. I don't, their rules make no sense. Even when they show like ashram, like the insider footage of like the, you know, the therapy where everyone's just like beating each other up and like screaming and
oh, right,
like,
from the documentary that was made back then.
I don't know if this is like, you know, legit either. Like ashram seems like a total, you know, could be like a put on thing. But the fact that I have any ambiguity about it, I think shows like that they did a good job.
Definitely.
In letting everything speak for itself.
And you know? I think that's what's interesting about seeing the Jonestown footage in there. Mm-hmm. And like, and they do flash Manson's face at some point. And it, you know, draws the comparison between this story and these other more famous stories that are far more categorically objectionable, morally, ethically wrong.
Yeah, you could say Jonestown, like, was, we all know about Jonestown.
Right.
People did not know about Rajneesh Param.
Yes, right. Yes. But the last thing about Sheila, not the last thing, obviously.
One more thing about Sheila.
Yet another.
Oh, Sheila.
It's really good to see a woman and like a woman person of color, like empowered. And no, it is. That's like, it's fun
be
to
a murderer,
see that.
Be an
Well, no, in the context of the cult, yes. Uh-huh. But I'm putting things in small silos here. But,
oh, okay.
But yes, to sort of respond to what you were talking about with Sheila, like I totally hear you, but at the same time, you're kind of rooting for her all along. And since this film is the story of her life, and it kind of takes her from cradle to where she's at now in older age, I think by definition, if you have a story that's set up that way at this length, it behooves you as a filmmaker to make that person sympathetic, and they have. And so I think in ways, if you're still watching the thing after like episode 3, I think you're kind of rooting for Sheila. Like, you know where it's going because they tease that right at the beginning. The one thing that I would take out filmmaking wise from the first episode, because they set up biggest wiretapping scandal, you know, biggest bioterrorism incident. But then they also tease that Sheila went to jail.
Oh, yeah.
I would have wanted that left out, mm-hmm. because I want to watch her and really root for her and then get to that point like deep in the series, mm-hmm. a little bit. That was the one thing that I was a little I pondered that choice that they made.
Too much foreshadowing in episode 1.
A little. I mean, no, I like the way they set everything, mm-hmm. up, because you knew where it was going and it seems so big, but it's a little bit like S-Town in the sense that there's a version of both of those stories that there's like no suspense, because it's like S-Town,
yeah.
The guy's dead. There's no murder. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all carrot.
Okay.
It's all stick, no carrot.
Just, we're talking purely formally and storytelling wise.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
We break this. And I think that is good to look at, because I just tried to watch Oregon Public Broadcasting did a very dry 1 hour take on this whole story with like a Wilford Brimley narrator. And I'm just like, this is like not anywhere near. It's still interesting, but like, it's just like the most bland, like Wikipedia version of this story, rather than what you get in Wild Wild Country is just fucking drama. Like, there's so much drama in there.
And I think it's really about, you know, when they reveal things, mm-hmm. and teasing it the way that they do allows them to, you know, mete out this information satisfyingly over many more episodes than maybe it would have been. Because, mm-hmm. there's a version of this story that's like a 10-minute, you know, nightly news piece. It's the Wikipedia page or whatever.
But I mean, I guess that's when you say, like, I think in that Oregon Public Broadcasting one, there's an interview with the lawyer that we see a lot of, Phil Tolks, a.k.a. Swami Premren. But getting Sheila interviewed, that was, like, I think what this had to, like, kind of center around. Mm-hmm. Like, just her perspective, like, just some of her insight into this.
Yeah.
Because I think I kept finding myself being like, why did she sit down with these people? What is she trying to get out of this? What, mm-hmm. is she trying to set? She's not even denying anything. She's just like,
right.
Why? Well, you know, what is her side of this? Like, why is she even doing this?
And do you think it was because, like, in the film that this other film that you saw, she hadn't had a chance really to tell it from her perspective? Or
I don't really know.
I mean,
I just wonder what her she's got
to
be thinking about a legacy or something. I mean, she doesn't seem apologetic though.
Nope.
She's a very, it's
right.
Like, because she wasn't trying to really set anything straight. Why did she do this interview? You know, it seemed like she was trying to say, to the followers of Osho now, like, don't deny this part of the history. Like, she's like, include this.
Right.
This is part of, like, whatever you want to think about it. We for real believed in this stuff. So,
well, one of the things that's absolutely left out is, I mean, by inference, you can kind of piece together some answer to this yourself. But what is the relationship that these characters have to this organization now?
Right.
It's not made, you know, abundantly clear. So you kind of have to guess, or, you know, you can pick up details here and there. But certainly with Sheila, there was this schism at some point. She still speaks with great love and affection, you know, for him. It looks like she's wearing a maroon kind of shawl, you know, like where, you know, she also is doing like physical therapy with people in like a fluorescent lit room in Switzerland. Like, she has like a
right
physical therapy business or something.
It's like
that.
It's like retirees. It's like for,
right.
It's like a hospice, I thought. Yeah.
Like a hospice. But, yeah. Older people. Yeah.
But lawyer dude, he's obviously still in love, you know.
Yeah, like, that he's actually maybe a more interesting. Like, in a lot of ways, it does seem like it's about him as well. Like,
well, and
he's the real Western dude who came into it as a hardcore believer to this day.
Yeah,
he still believes in Osho.
And started he also off as a
badass
apologize.
Lawyer.
Yeah, totally.
Right,
like a take no shit kind of lawyer who, like, his transformation into this cult, into being a Rajanishi, is pretty, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, it's not something you see a lot of times where people are like type A personalities who get caught up into a cult like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people were successful Westerners. Like, that's what, actually the episode one. Here's the part that I got really into is just like, I know a lot of weirdo utopian Californian people,
right?
Mm-hmm. That we're always talking about, like, let's go, you know, like take Port Costa and like turn it into its own thing. Or like, if like, I'm like, oh, 150 people can start their own city. Like, yeah, I know enough people that we could do that. And then, but I also think in the back of my head, I'm like, something is going to go bad with everyone I know. I'm like, you can't get 150 people to work together. But just like the amount of enthusiasm and everything, and the fact that they had the money to do it was impressive. Like, I was impressed by in the first episode of just like, without getting into the ideology of what they were about, I'm like, this as a feat of like public planning is very good. As city planning goes, they've crossed a lot of T's. And like, I found it really interesting the first two episodes, like how much legal like wiggle room they were finding. They're just like, America, it's like a freedom of religion, right? We're going to make you prove it. We're really going to push you on that
one.
And like just the way they kind of sneakily get around all of like certain laws, or just like, so when you talk about the like gun laws or even just like voting rights and like, you know, with the homeless and stuff like that, all that stuff I found interesting to the point where it did not cross an actual line, like drugging the homeless. Like, right. It's just fucking, I'm just like, at first I'm just like, they're doing it. They're doing, like, I wish Christians would do this. And then I'm like, oh no, this is not the way it's supposed to roll out. There's so many things. It's like, you were like 3/4 of the way there. You're like 80%. You had like the 80% of it down. And then the last 20%, you're like, let's murder. No, let's not do that.
They're the 80%ers. I think it's less bumbling than that. I think it's a lot more. I think in my viewpoint, it was a lot more calculated. I mean, they would get people specifically for their skill set. Like the original mayor, who I don't remember his.
Well, there was Krishna Devi. I think he was a mayor that flipped. That's
right.
The one that the mayor that turned over to the feds.
That guy,
Krishna Devi. Yeah.
Had a particular skill set that they needed. I think with part of which was like setting up municipalities and things like that. So I think they're less bumbling, less Mr. Magoo, and a lot more conniving and planning, you know.
Right. Like, yeah, I'm wondering like what their plan was if the homeless stayed in after the election. Like, what was their plan at that point?
To,
like,
kill them?
Well, they're going to do all the menial work. It's fine. You know, like, they're just going to, like, we're going to keep them happy and drunk until the election.
Well, so, I mean, Jane, the Australian lady, I mean, the one who literally carried out the murder attempt, also describes how she cleaned public toilets for like her first 2 years or something like that.
That sounds like Scientology. That's a real Scientology move right there.
Yeah. I mean, that's what a successful cult does. I mean, it breaks you down into your DNA structure so that you feel like you're just part of the mass and you're not an individual. And then they just get you to clean toilets and kill state attorneys.
What's weird is like this cult didn't seem they were kind of hedonistic, right? It wasn't about a lot of it was kind of like
well,
do whatever
is
you
the
want.
Sex guru, I
yeah,
think.
The sex
yeah,
guru.
Yeah, which cult isn't though? Are they all about having sex? Which is,
oh,
you know,
man.
It's awesome. There's always some sex in there somewhere, isn't it?
Did you? I sent you guys both a link to that Nexium story. Did you read any of that stuff?
Oh, no, I didn't look at that.
But wait, do you know anything about that? Is this like a sidebar? Oh, Paco, you've read about this? Or you
yeah.
Heard about the Nexium thing?
I have a friend who's been posting about it for a long time on Facebook. He's been talking about it for quite a while. And now that it's hitting the mainstream, he's feeling very vindicated about it. But yeah, it's yet another sex cult where it's like
for sure a guy who's like I'm a genius, I have a 240 IQ, I'm the smartest man in the room, and then like that, but women won't have sex with me, so I better create a structure
right.
in which I have power to like make that happen. And it ends with him branding women like with like they think
his initials
getting a tattoo, but they're basically getting his initials branded
oh,
on
no.
them. And it like involves a bunch of Hollywood actors and stuff. It's
yeah.
fucking weird.
It's
real dark.
Much like attempted murder, that's crossing a line.
Well, it's human trafficking, I guess, is the charge they actually brought the guy in for was human trafficking,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a, you know, they've uncovered a giant pyramid scheme as well where you basically paid this guy for stuff that you'll never get. And he ended up with a $25 million bank account somewhere. But I want to bring up Sheila. Did you so doing some research for this? I did find that. So the mayor that flipped for the FBI in his 45-page mm-hmm. dossier that he gave to the FBI, which you can read online, he alleges that Sheila murdered her first husband. Did you guys read?
No, I did not pick up on that at all. No.
Well, the one who had Hodgkin's disease.
Yes.
I mean, they tell that story from her perspective at length.
From a mercy killing, but she had him and poisoned.
Oh.
So that, because
they don't say that in the film though. She,
no, they
she
don't.
Just says that, you know, I think that he's going to die to the Bhagwan. He's like, yes. And you must let him die, you know, and don't look troubled. And then he's dead all of a sudden.
So that's something that Krishna Devi, the former mayor, told the feds.
Yes.
Yeah. And interesting.
Part of it's because Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, one of his teaching was about assisted suicide. He was in favor of it. Even mm-hmm. if your child doesn't seem like it's going to have a good life for whatever reasons, it's fine just to like kill that kid. That
was that mentioned in the movie?
No. Nothing about the teaching. I feel like the teachings were left out of this
movie. Well, they're condensed down to so little in the first episode. But I think that it's mostly about, and this is, I think, another really strong choice on the filmmakers' side. It's presenting the people and their experiences, their recollections of what drew them in, what they were looking for, what they saw in him, and certainly their first encounters with him. And that's what we get. And we get just a very brief condensant of his idea of the new man who is both acquisitional in the way of the West and like an Eastern style mystic. Mm-hmm. But that's all that you get from the teachings. Yeah. So like I both am missed that and was curious about it. Mm-hmm. But obviously some of these things would have complicated the storytelling a little bit.
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, this is more about the legal problems that, which is making it a small sentence, but like it's more about what they did in Antelope, Oregon than it was about the teachings or what happened even in India and the fact that they were basically ran out of India as well.
I think tax evasion in India was one of the issues too, right? Was it tax
they really
evasion?
Yeah. Went over that briefly. They're like, mm-hmm. Indira Gandhi was in charge, so we had to leave. And like,
yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Well, that's what apparently like the Bhagwan made his name for being anti-Gandhi. That was his thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. In some of the research I was reading that he was against like kind of the socialism and Gandhi and was more into like free love and
Rolls
Royces. Yeah. He's like, let's do this thing with the Rolls Royces. But I like what, I mean, I want to bring up something that fascinates me, and you wrote about it a little bit in our survey, is like your interest in how people get drawn into cults. Like,
right.
what are your feelings about that, around that? And have you ever been in a cult?
I think the closest thing I came to a cult was my long professional association with McSweeney's.
Yeah, I can see that. I see what you're talking about. I see what you're saying.
He did a lot for me. He's one of his personal hero of mine.
He's so handsome, too.
He is quite handsome. He's got these beautiful blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's something I love cult stories and why, or, you know, I do enjoy cult films. I'm not particularly an obsessive fan of them, but when I hear about one, I probably would want to watch it. And I think that, yeah, there's something relatable in these people in this film about their sort of searching nature. And I think that that's why they, in the movie, they connected to the 60s, even though we're talking about the 80s, actually. Not quite like the Reagan 80s yet, but like we're talking about 81 through 84 is when the movie mostly takes place. But they do a lot in the first episode to connect it to the 60s because I think that they want to tap into that. You know, this is a time when there was a cultural revolution in America that is significant, that like basically like what drew people to be hippies and, you know, to do the 60s are things that are still very much alive in our culture today. So it's like searching for answers is still kind of a cool thing and acceptable thing to do. And like establishment religions are kind of not as cool. Mm-hmm. And so like, I don't know, I vibe with that a little bit. Like, I think that I want to get my chart done eventually. I'm a Pisces.
Awesome. There is something about brainwashing, about giving yourself up to an ideology and more specifically a person that is fascinating, because I think like for a lot of, I think people who are into watching films about cults and just reading about it are people that are pretty much like into control need, you know, like have a lot of control in their lives and like feel this obsession about losing control, having no control, giving control over. Because I know in my mind, I look at this and I'm like, what? Like, who could fall for this shit? You know, like anytime I see a cult thing, I'm like, you fucking kidding me? The guy's got silver shoes on and wears a purple fucking Doctor Who outfit. Like, why would, like, who would fall for that?
You're talking about this one specifically or just in general when you see, like, just you just don't. Like
in think, general, think,
yeah,
like the Heaven's Gates thing, like what? And then people die for this shit. Like they're drinking Kool-Aid, they're being suffocated or whatever. Like it just, I'm fascinated by people who seem extremely gullible. Whatever the fuck's going on in their life, they need to give over their thinking to someone else. This like cult of personality or an ideology, but generally it's a cult of personality, and just to give it over to them and just be like, "Tell me what I need to do, please, because I don't know what to do with my fucking life."
Well, I'm for some reason thinking about like the imposter and like how it's more like the extremes that one person will go to be in that alpha role. I think that's always interesting. It's more like most people kind of just want to just go along with stuff. And I guess even if they're like into spiritual seeking, it's like, who is trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes? Like, what is that? Is it coming from a place of malice? Is it coming from a place of actually thinking they're doing something good for people? In the case of like this particular group, I mean, what you're saying about like the sort of like 60s aspect of it, it's a weird merge of the 60s and the 80s because it is like super materialist.
Right. Yeah.
It's super materialist. It's super like do what you want. I'm sure like, you know, if cocaine was there, the cops might have come earlier, but it feels a little coked up. Everyone feels like they're just like, it's more like the tail end of the 70s. Right, that
we
is,
got the producer of The Godfather coming over.
Exactly. Yeah. Like all these like Western, like successful, like white people that kind of just want to like make their life have more meaning. Like we're going to outsource our meaning to the Bhagwan.
Right.
But also just like that kind of like that self-help movement of the 70s. I think we'd say like, you know, connects to like the jogging and like exercise and yoga in that aspect. So it's sort of like a self-help thing, which kind of dovetails with like 60s interests in like Eastern spirituality, and then like 80s just like Rolls Royce, like our leader has a nice watch, he must be good.
Yeah,
you know, right. Which is like how you end up with like someone like we have right now. But
yeah, and they nail that, like all those sort of like slightly contradictory things are mm-hmm. summed up in so many different beautiful moments in the film. Like it's the guy who was the president of the corporation, like the shell thing that they had, who has the perfectly coiffed beard and he's doing Tai Chi like on his property somewhere overlooking, you know, the ocean in Big Sur or whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, Marin County.
Yeah, of
you
course.
Mariner. Yeah. It's the lawyer who like, he's like, hey, look, I made like $800,000 a year. I was eating croissant in, you know, in bed with my girlfriend and drinking a, you know, cafe con leche. And when I, you know, like it's yeah. And then he's, and the then first he's crying yeah. about seeing the guy for the first time. He's right. like literally in tears, you know? So it's like, so you are not a cult guy, Paco, but when you see him choking up, when you see the lawyer like unable to put into words and overcome with emotion, you don't find that relatable at all?
No. Yeah. No, I mean, no, I don't. I see it as just someone who's just brainwashed.
Shut up, stop crying.
Yes, this guy yeah. is a fucking criminal. What the fuck's your problem? I'm part of that might be because I grew up in such a weird religious household that I watched this shit since I was a kid. This fucking religious brainwashing was around me since I was a little child. So like when I, this is the same knee-jerk reaction I think I had towards my dad and my stepmom, who were just so fucking religious that I'm just like, what is your problem? You need to be able to think for yourself, right? I mean, isn't that
part
of it?
What was their religion?
It's a free denominational agape. So there was no specific religion. It was basically came out of the California in the 70s and 80s for wayward hippies that were like, you know, I need to get my life together. I did too many drugs. I drank too much. I chased too many girls. I was a bad person. And now I'm wayward and I need to find God and whatever. But we had this strange version of that where my dad was our pod leader, because there's a family of six. There's a pod of families, and each one had a leader. My dad was the leader of that one, and people would come to him if they wanted to buy a car, if they wanted to paint their house. You know, they had to get permission from my dad. And so, like, growing up and watching people do that, sit down with my dad and be like, we want to get a dog. My dad's like, I'm not sure that's a good idea right now. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this is bullshit. And so, like, when I see this guy crying and doing his you know, pyrotechnics for the camera, I'm just like, this is just dumb. But I could see how people get, I could see how and why people would want to be part of something like that that's bigger than them. But it's just like, it just boggles my mind how people could just give their life over like that.
When you say it's like pyrotechnics for the camera, I do think that dude, Phil Tolks, I feel like he believes what he's saying. I get that sense.
Oh, yeah.
He seems genuine. I don't think like he may have been brainwashed in a way by this whole experience, but he's still like a smart dude who seems to believe what he's saying. I do feel that. So even though I see what you're also saying.
Do you feel like your childhood can predict how you respond to this Netflix series?
Mine in general?
Yours in particular. Well, I think that we just hit on something pretty interesting. Well,
yeah. Say more about this, Paco.
You talked about this a lot on the podcast?
Yeah, generally,
we've done a couple of cult things, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes.
It seems related to the opinion that you have about this piece of movie making.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, for sure. My childhood and growing up in like religious settings and households and is definitely sways my opinion about these people I see in this documentary, for sure, because they remind me of the same families I would see that would come over for potluck at our house. And I'd just be like, you guys are a bunch of fucking dumbasses. And also extremely manipulative. The people, the leaders that I would see who were laughing at other people's expenses, they're fucking hypocrites. They were power hungry, control freaks who knew what they were doing. I mean, like I see the same thing in Sheila. It's like, to me, it's just posturing and it's like purposeful. Like they want power.
I would love to know I'm sure that it was an evolving thing and probably is too, but when you arrived at that perspective, because something that's not in the movie, again, another thing that's left out, because that's what good creative people do. They leave things out. but where are the kids in this? I mean, we hear about Jane's son for a moment, but the kids are there, you know, like living this life. What kind of, you know, deranged psychedelic summer camp experience was Rajneesh Puram for them?
I wish I could find someone. That's the thing. I know a lot of people Oregon. I'm like, I wonder if I know anyone. They'd probably be about like in their mid 30s who grew up in this. Like it was maybe like 4 or 5 when this was happening, right?
Because there are those things when you're a kid that just feel normal, even though they're not. Yeah. And then there are those things where you start to realize, like, oh, yeah, mommy's lying. Mm-hmm. Mommy's lying. I mean, I try to think about, like, experiences like that. I mean, I'm generally trying to get away from the idea that your childhood predicts your adulthood or your childhood would predict how you feel about something. But in this case, Paco, I'm wondering, like, was there ever a time at which you were like, oh, yeah, of course, like, dude man has to ask my dad if he can have a dog or not. Like, was that ever normal for you? Or can you not even remember a time you always had a clear view on that as something?
Yeah, they converted at some point when you were cognizant of what was going on. Or did they?
Yeah, it was a different. The problem was, is we jumped from church to church depending on basically the fucking weather. So like when that happens, when you're 8 or 7 and you start seeing things as kind of like an intelligent being, not necessarily having lots of common sense, but you can tell when things are wrong or right. When you jump from church to church because of different scandals, different things that are happening, you start to be like, well, there should just be one church. You know, like, I think kids see things a lot more clearer too about things. And for me, it was like, I don't understand. To me, Christians were always just hypocrites, you know, when I was a kid, and mostly because of my family and just the people my parents hung out with. But, that definitely informs how I see religion today. I mean, my stepsister was in a cult in Oklahoma. She went to Oral Roberts University. And my dad had to go with a friend of his and get her at midnight out of this cult that she had been brought into. So, like, when you read about, and she's one of those kind of people that is just like, wait, did you just say hi to me? I'm going to follow you home and we can read the Bible together, kind of, you know.
Not that that school is necessarily the cult. There was something that led her to a cult in that school. Although it is, he was this famous televangelist, right?
Yes.
I think that it's a cult. It's the world's largest sculpture of praying hands.
Praying hands.
These giant golden praying hands on the campus.
You can see them for miles, apparently. Yeah.
I had a girlfriend from Tulsa, and we took a tour of kind of posing as prospective students just because we wanted to see it.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think this cult wasn't necessarily part of the university. They were there to nab freshman students who looked wayward and were just like, we have Bible study. And then 2 weeks later, she's like, oh, they won't let me leave. I can't go grocery shopping. And then she managed to sneak a cell phone and call my dad and be like, I think I'm in trouble. I can't leave the house. They're monitoring my movements and stuff. And so
you
he
have
was
an
like,
understandable distrust of like all kind of organized religion, however organized it is, from the small to the large.
Yeah, and I've never believed in organized religion. I do believe in spirituality, and I think that everyone should basically just invent their own religion, and if, you know, whatever works for you, you know.
As long as there's less than 150 people.
And as long as you're getting laid, dude, it's all right.
And don't poison 750 people.
I have like a couple of commandments. It's only like 3 or 4. One of them is like, don't poison people. Don't blend up the beaver. The beaver is sacred. Do not blend the beaver.
I mean, if you are sympathetic to the Rajneeshis, those are the only lines we can draw.
Right. Yeah. Don't blend the beaver, dude. Stop. But yeah, I mean, so of course my background, you know, and I'm kind of a skeptic about pretty much everything anyways. And like whenever I see somebody, I feel like I see crocodile tears usually before I feel any empathy for people in these kind of situations.
So is there a character in the movie that you do sympathize with, or are they all crazy?
In this
the prosecutor, you like the prosecutor, don't you?
I kind of did like the prosecutor. Yeah. The guy at the desk that they talked to in the office, that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of did like him.
I mean, he came across to me as more bigoted than the small town people.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, I didn't see, I didn't get big. See, this is another thing with me is I didn't feel any bigotry from the small town people either.
Oh, you did?
Really?
Huh.
And not really. No, I think I thought they were the kind of folksome, like, I'm no big city lawyer, but, you know, like they were the porch swing type people that were just like, what the fuck's going on? Especially the guy in the overalls who I loved. I can't remember
that's the
name.
Guy who's like, in the Nike family. Is that the guy? He's like,
no, the overalls guy. Oh, he was the cute round mustachio spectacle. I think he's the current mayor.
He's Wilford Brimley of this documentary.
Right. Yeah.
He is just folksy and. But he also took them on. Remember, he got on the city government when they were first taking over, and he was the only non-Rajaneeshi to be part of that city government. They show him, like, you know, when he's 30 years earlier. And he was like, fuck these guys. Like, I'm going to be part of this. I want to know what's going on. And he's like one of the talking heads in this doc. But I thought he was great because he was, you know, he was like trying to remember that chemist's name. And he was like, Puda, or he's like, that's a Spanish word. He's like, Puja.
Yeah.
I think your name is. That was a good moment. I was curious about the choice to leave that one in. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he accidentally says Puta, and he's like, well, yeah, that's a word that we don't want to say in Spanish or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But I think that that's something where they're showing you like, they're telling you something there about what his small town perspective is and like what kind of a person he is. But it's also like, it's kind of still like charming in that way. It's like, if he was your uncle and your friend was like, dude, Uncle Joey's a racist. You're like, no, it's just Uncle Joey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my sympathy went to these people of Antelope, Oregon, who were just like, we just a sleepy retirement bedroom community, and they were overran by this cult, and they were just like, what the fuck
so
is going
right
on?
Away, episode one, you're already like, I don't trust these red hippies.
No, of course not. No, I don't trust them. I didn't trust them from the first.
Interesting.
Before I pushed play on episode one. No.
Right.
But I also Richard and I are from California. Yeah, so right. I think we have like a little bit more like, yeah, whatever, bro. Just you stay on your side of the mountain.
Right, right.
Kind of.
I mean, you can almost smell the Nag Champa.
You just said it, but it was before you pressed play, you had already kind of, you came in with a fully formed opinion almost.
I also remember this story. Like I was eight or 9 years old. I remember, like you said, I remember the Rolls Royces thing. I remember seeing Osho's picture and he looks, I mean, this is a weird thing to say, but he looks a lot like my dad, which is also very odd. I know. Strange.
You say more about the beard and the skull cap.
So many issues are coming up today. Yeah, no, this has become, you're getting free therapy from us on this podcast.
I mean, generally what I've heard about this series is that people tend to have contrasting views, like the ones that we're kind of espousing. But I think that maybe the way out of that can only be told in the past tense.
Maybe.
I mean, there's something about what your experiences and your kind of view of things going into it that I think creates your opinion of the people who you meet in the documentary, right?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, they're also not going to make this documentary because 30 years later, Bhagwan is a beautiful person and he helped a lot of people and you know, everyone got free groceries. I mean, they're not going to make a documentary that ends nicely. They're going to make it because these guys were a criminal organization and they got away with a lot of shit, including trying to kill people and poisoning almost 800 people and wiretapping and then trying to flee the country. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're not going to make it because it's a good story. They're going to make it because it was compelling and there's lots of crazy shit happened. So
did you feel sorry for him when they were dragging him around from jail to jail and he was this old frail man?
No.
I guess all of 57
all
years
of
old.
Like, yeah, 55 yeah. year
he
old
he looked
man.
Old and he looked skinny.
I mean, not necessarily. I wish I would have known. It would have been nice to have known more about him and the inner workings. Obviously, Sheila was the main conceit of this documentary. And I did think it was really cool that they were able to talk to her now and to see her now versus because she looks so, you know, motherly and, you know, older. And, you know, she looks awesome. She looks nice. But like, obviously Bhagwan he died in 1990 or something like that.
90.
So you can't really hear his side of the story, but I just don't believe that he was a innocent player in all this. I just, especially when he doesn't say anything for 3 years. And one of the first things he says is like, she doesn't like me cause I didn't fuck her. And she's just like being a bitch. Like that's like, come on, you know, like what kind of godly person is this? That's always where it comes down to for me is like, this is when you see their people like Christians or spiritual people's true self is when they're kind of caught or pushed into a corner and they're going to be like, fuck you. You're a bitch. You didn't fuck me. You know, that's where they're like the true colors come.
I thought that part was very interesting because it's also the moment when by kind of calling her out publicly and starting to make accusations against Sheila, the Bhagwan basically invites the investigators to come and break it all up, you know?
Like, yes.
And so like somehow maybe he was overcome you know, what we call like separating emotions in business. Like maybe he was overcome by his emotions in that period and it ended up being his undoing.
Yeah, maybe. With all that being said, I do want to preface with, I think this is a remarkable documentary series. And the, I don't know how the filmmakers, after only making a short doc before this.
Oh, really? Were able That's to, all their experience? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, about the Bastards of Baseball or something like that.
Yeah, the Bastards of Baseball, like a short film about baseball, I guess. And with like 300 hours of archival footage, I don't know who, and I also don't know who the editor is in on this doc, but whoever it is deserves some sort of award. I mean, the editing is superb.
No, the editing was amazing. And the archival is so incredible. It's so rich. Like that's what hits you over the head in the first episode. It's they're doing these shots, these sort of atmospheric shots in Oregon in present day and coupling them with the archival shots that they have. And like any emotion that's described, they're like, and that's when he started, you know, then we started to see the look, one of the townspeople says, and it's like cut to guy making crazy eyes in maroon robe. It's like they have every shot, you know, like. And the access to that archival, I think, is obviously one of the things that make for a good 6 hours. Yeah. You know,
I think that's how this got pitched to the brothers, the Way brothers. There was an archivist who had gotten a hold of all this news footage that didn't get used in the news clips.
Oh, okay.
And so that was like, 300 hours of that stuff. There was a stuff that was available in the public record and there was all this archival stuff. And they're just like, someone needs to do something with this. It's and then they're just like, these guys were too young to know about it when it happened, so they just kind of found out about it through this archivist, and they're just like, yeah, there's a story here.
Yeah.
And it can't be told in a feature form.
Huh.
I don't think it could be,
I also love it when subjects of documentaries had the, well, they didn't have the foresight, but like also took videos of themselves. Like, I love when documentaries use footage that the subjects had actually made themselves, like The Devil and Daniel Johnston, you know, where he was filming himself from like being a teenager, and also like capturing the Freedmans. They had actual like family footage and stuff. Like I love docs that have that, because it's a, there's a certain like element of like, did you know like something like this was going to happen? Like, what was the thinking there?
I thought that some of the stuff in the first episode was so incredible that I literally was like, is this recreation footage shot on old video format? Because like when they're getting ready for him to come into the town, they're setting up the red carpet. There are a series of shots. It's approximately like red carpet on the sidewalk being cleaned by a dustbuster. Okay.
That's literally technology.
Cut to guy playing flute.
Yeah.
Cut to non-Rajneeshi guy making the most hilarious, like, what
the expression? Fuck?
And I was like, they didn't just find these shots in like the 300 hours of footage, but in fact, they did.
Yeah. I was listening to an interview they did on The Ringer, and they said, like, they just worked with one editor, and like one of the guy's wives also helped them. But they were like, we couldn't outsource this editing to other people the way sometimes people do with documentaries. Like, we had to kind of just like know the story. So they had I'm sure they logged it all, but then they were just like, okay, this is what each of these six episodes is going to kind of focus on. Let's pull from what we all know.
You got to know your tape.
Yeah.
You got to log everything. My grad school mentor, John Els. You have to log every second, otherwise you're wasting time.
Oh my
God. It all before you start cutting.
Dude,
we
interviewed someone who like they're just like put it all in an Excel file. They like logged everything in an Excel file. I'm like, and then they just had to pull from that. I'm like, oh my God.
Well, I was reading that the Oregon Sentinel had a lot of this archival footage, and a lot of the news media from the 80s was using tape and not film. It's like right in 81 when they flipped to tape and not film, and they would reuse that tape.
The tape, right,
They would re-record over it, but they knew that this story was going to be very important to the history of Oregon, so they saved a lot of these videotapes.
Yeah, it's like U-matic tape, or it's like the big tape,
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Awesome. Yeah, because you just like it's like I delete these episodes when we're done from my disc.
From your memory.
That someone's got it somewhere else.
Yeah, a lot of the footage had the same kind of artifact like band on the top of it.
The tracking thing. Yeah,
like old VHS looking. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously from a single source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Rajneesh case. the scope of this was enormous. To move the ashram from Pune, a small town, lock, stock, and barrel, to the United States. And in the course of that, commit thousands of felonies. So our goal was to find out who the architects of that would be. Clearly, a target was immediately Sheila.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
If you like a good murder mystery story, you'll love June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game where Detective June Parker unravels the mystery of her sister's death. Travel back to the beautifully illustrated 20s, find clues, discover hidden objects, and watch the story unfold with new chapters released weekly. Put your detective skills to the test. Download June's Journey on Android or iOS, or play online via Facebook games.
Was there a time for you guys where you felt yourself emotionally shifting from one foot to the or to the other in watching this, for like Sheila or Jane or the lawyer?
For me, it's when you saw them getting guns. Like, it's like, which I think is the end of episode 2.
Right.
It's like, then all of a sudden you, like, Bhagwan walks back off of giving a speech and you see a guy with like a fucking orange beret and like a machine gun, like backing up.
Yeah.
Like, this is for real now. This is for real.
And then in that same shot, you see another guy walk in with another gun. Yeah. It's one of the most amazing.
That
moments.
Is a great way to end that episode.
And so what's so great about that is that that's exactly the thing that I think the storytelling set up in the very beginning of episode 1. Because you see these rural townspeople and you're like, these are the kind of people who voted for Trump. These are the kind of people who have guns. But then by the end of episode 2, it's like, nope. It's the cult that has the guns, you know? And so I think that that's a really effective like way of meeting out.
That was my like kind of emotional flip of just like on top of the constant, like, what the fuck feeling like every time something's introduced in the first, I'd say up to episode 5. By then, I'm just like, okay, I kind of see what's going to end up happening here, the denouement of this. But it's like just like every introduction of another bizarro fact, I'm like, this, you could not write this. Like, I could not write this. Like, anything I've thought about cults could not write this. Also, another thing I was thinking about, because in the Oregon, the 1 hour version of this, they talk about how like some guy from Texas came in and bought up all the Rolls Royces at the end. And then they used some of that money to like resettle some of the people that were in the Rajneeshpuram. But I'm just like, oh, I know so many people in Portland that have weird 70s furniture. Maybe there's just like the best yard sale ever at the end of this.
Right.
Like 1985 rolls around. I'm just like, oh yeah, I got a tractor for cheap. I got this weird hot tub. We got this underground, like, you know, recording booth. Like, that was the thing, like, too. That was another flip for me. It was just like, oh, she was taping all this stuff. She is just like being like Nixon. She had that, that side of her, you know?
Right. Yeah,
but well, it was just like mostly it was her. Yeah, I guess.
But it was all like internal facing, you know. Yeah. It was like that. That's what, when you hear biggest wiretapping case in the history of the United States in the beginning, the way they tease that is so great. When you get to it, it's like, oh yeah, she was just doing some paranoid stuff, and like she could do it. You know, it wasn't like, I mean, it wouldn't be of interest to most people actually.
Right.
You know, like it was for like internal political reasons within the commune or the cult.
Well, the mayor that flipped for the FBI in his affidavit, he said that she would also open everyone's letters because she was into gossip. She really enjoyed reading gossip.
Dude, so, how do you have the time to monitor this many people? That's the thing about like who's listening to these tapes also. Like, how much manpower does it take to like even listen to these tapes? Oh, man.
Well, they save time with the blending the beavers because that was just... You know, we don't need the whole lab. Burn the lab down and spend more time listening to tapes because we can just blend some more beavers.
The lab.
That's a one-stop solution.
We gotta cast this doctor. podcast is done.
Now, we like to do a thing on this show where we play a game where we cast the film version of this doc. And I feel like, you know, Source Family is being turned into a fictional series.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. I think Source Family is being turned into a fictional series. This, I think, could easily be like
his father, multiple John Misty seasons. Playing the source leader guy.
I don't know who's playing the source leader, dude. That guy seemed a little scrawny to be the Yohawa. I don't think so. but we like to do this, and I know we asked you if you don't have anything. I have a couple ideas. Paco, you got any ideas for any castings?
I do.
In the Lifetime version of this?
Sure. The Lifetime version of this, the Swami Prem Nuran, the mayor lawyer guy.
The lawyer guy. Yeah.
I mean, the early 80s version, Tom Cruise. He looks... Tom Cruise. I mean, can't you see him with those 80s glasses?
The mustache.
And that mustache and that hair. I mean, it's great hair.
For some reason, like, because I just watched that other thing I watched, he's prominent in that other Oregon public broadcasting one, but he doesn't have the mustache, which is very unsettling. So, like, yeah, when you see Tom Selleck without his mustache, it's just uncanny. It's just like, I don't know. I think that's a good casting for him. I got a weird one for the Krishna Devi, the mayor who flips to the feds, which is Brett Gelman. If you know Brett Gelman,
Yeah,
you kind of see he has that weaselly quality to him. Just like, I'm the mayor. I'm very dramatic. I'm scared of the feds. So I feel like a little ambivalent about that dude, but I for some reason wanted to have Brett Gelman play him.
Yeah.
And I think I had a weird one for the Bhagwan. Tell me if you guys feel me on this one. Just maybe it's just the eyes, but Stanley Kubrick.
Oh.
I actually posted an image of Stanley Kubrick on our Twitter feed and said, is anyone watching Wild Wild Country? And no one noticed it.
Oh, wow.
No one called me on it. I'm like, it's Kubrick. like in the eyebrows and the eyes, just like at a certain point, you can kind of see that, but not like in the rest of the, I was looking for a big Kubrick beard photo. I couldn't find a good one,
right,
but I guess that is whitewashing. That would be whitewashing. Right,
I mean, that's why I didn't really have any ideas, because I was like, well, I would just have
to... think of any Indian actors? Is that why, Richard?
I'm not a Bollywood fan, and I can't think of many Indian actors who would play, like, for example, a young Sheila.
No, I mean, I was really stuck on that, too.
Like, I was thinking of Aparna for young Sheila.
Really? I don't see it at all. I mean, that would be actually really funny to have, if, like, you're gonna do like the documentary now version of it,
right,
just having a pardon on Churla, right, being like, poison that person, here's a syringe. Like, that's a terrible, I'm sorry if you're listening, you're not listening, it's fine, but did you have any other? There's so many characters in here, though, too.
I just had David Koechner,
David Koechner
as the rancher, because they have the same facial expressions.
Right.
Yes.
That'd be good.
Or there's a guy who looks like David Koechner who is in the McDonald's movie.
He was in Fargo.
Is escaping me. Yeah, the guy from Fargo. He's kind of like a Koechner type.
Yeah.
He would also fit in there.
Oh, him. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah. Yeah. that character actor.
That guy.
Whose name
we
can't remember.
That character's in all that stuff. Love him.
Yeah.
I also wrote down Sannyas Queen. That's, I think, what we should say for the Sannyas. That's what we say for Sheila. It's like Yas Queen meets Sannyasin. Sannyas Queen.
Queen.
That's good, George.
Thanks.
I'll tell you what.
Occasionally, the writing does itself. Richard, do you want to talk? Let's plug some stuff you're working on. We already mentioned the Gorilla Tacos cookbook, which is available at all bookstores, I imagine.
Yeah, it's at Skylight. This is not like a neighborhood podcast,
well,
but
we are
in Los Feliz, so I thought of Skylight. But yeah, it's at bookstores. It's out on 10-speed press. Check it out. Two R's and two L's. Gorilla Tacos.
You brought
I made
over
up
a
all
hot...
the recipes.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I just worked with a chef. I just helped him.
You did bring over a hot sauce.
I brought over some hot sauce that I made. Yeah, it's fermented chilies and garlic with pickled persimmons, and I call it Fuyu Fire.
Where's my hot sauce?
A, Oh, we're gonna have to send you one.
You know,
we also have a competing hot sauce sponsor for this show. This is the only show that has a hot sauce sponsor that we're not mentioning in this episode because it gets brought us the hot sauce.
That's funny.
Well, mine's not actually available, but I was at a store where they were selling my cookbook. I was there to like sign a book, and the guy was like, "By the way, if you want to sell your hot sauce here, like you're welcome to." And so I might take him up on that.
Dude,
what do I have to plug?
Awesome.
Is that the Chinatown cookbook store? Is that
no, they didn't.
Not, oh, a different cookbook
Ken and
store.
Michelle of Now Serving did not offer that to me.
I have a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Have you watched Ugly Delicious yet?
Yes.
Do you like it?
And you wrote for Lucky Peach?
I wrote for Lucky Peach,
well.
Yeah.
A
lot of friends of mine make very brief cameos in Ugly Delicious. I thought Ugly Delicious was great. I mean, I love so much of what Netflix is doing. They're doing so many amazing series right now. And I love that show. I'm glad that it was a different kind of food show.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was also a complicated show. I've complicated a few feelings about it because, you know.
That's going to be, well, let's do an extra episode on this. We'll do like a Patreon-only episode
on going.
Ugly Delicious, yeah.
I loved Ugly Delicious, yeah.
Me too. Okay, keep plugging. Sorry,
I don't know. What do I have to plug, George? I don't think I have to plug anything, do I?
Well, you're not.
Oh, I just joined LinkedIn. I joined LinkedIn 2 days ago.
Richard Parks on LinkedIn.
Yeah, Richard Parks 3 on LinkedIn.
You said that there's an audio piece you have in a KCRW series
that you
can promote that can be announced now.
This, I know that this show is probably not going to come out tomorrow, but this would be the first official announcement of KCRW's new music documentary series, Lost Notes.
Yeah.
What? Everybody tune into Lost Notes. And I did, this story about a flexi disc and the $1 million that it won a family and the fallout from that at a little town called Galax, Virginia. So look for that sometime.
Cool.
I think the episodes start coming out next month. And my friend David Weinberg did a great piece on the song Louie Louie, which has a fascinating story.
It was
the guy
like
who
banned
wrote it,
and
sold
stuff,
the rights
right?
for like $200. There's the F word, and there's all sorts of federal investigators get involved. It's a great story.
That's awesome.
Lost Notes is the name of the show.
Mm-hmm.
KCRW, really great place for podcasts. And is this sort of like a half hour that's going to be on the air as well, or it's podcast form?
Exactly.
On air?
Yeah, they're half hour pieces, and I think they're like 6 or 8 of them.
Damn. How long does it take you to work on a half hour piece? Like
I went to Virginia for that in like August, but I mean, it's just been going on in the background since then, but it takes a while. I mean, I went for too long and had too much fun, and I have way too much tape. I was thinking about starting a sub podcast called Galax Deep Cuts because like there's so many things that I couldn't quite get to, you know.
That's awesome.
That's what happens when you do a story. That's what storytelling is all about. You have to decide.
You gotta kill some babies.
You have to cut something off, and that's what these filmmakers did so well in Wild Wild Country. All that stuff that was left out, I'm glad they left it out because it made for a great viewing experience.
I know, I'm sure they could have done an 8-parter. They had so much more to dig into. And there's people, I think, that they got for background for interviews that they decided not to focus on because they said they wanted to kind of be very character-based.
Right.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about Jane and, like, her crazy, like, ending of, like, ugh. Yeah, but we're going to have to save that for something else, I guess. But not right now. No Jane Starks right now. Richard, and you have a website, and you have some stuff you can't tell us about yet, but I guess we're going to hear about it eventually.
Yeah, I work for Amazon, so unless everybody
Jeff
will
Bezos
sign an
has
NDA
to kill
right
us.
Now. Yeah, exactly.
You made a film that I remember when we first met, you showed me a film that you worked on Music Man Murray.
Right, yeah.
Which is,
you can check it out on Vimeo, Music Man Murray. It's a short documentary about a man with hundreds of thousands of records and his son.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I want to check that out. I love records.
Yeah, I can see some behind you on the video conference.
Actually,
I've got a nice little collection.
Actually, like we have the same IKEA smorgasbord or whatever.
filled
with
Urca.
Books and records. Yeah.
Richard, this was awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us about this. And George, thanks for bringing this to all, at least to my attention. This is a great documentary series.
You know, sometimes I feel like the mother of the world.
Yeah,
and,
you should.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Richard.
And now Bill Callahan to play us out.
Yeah, exactly. We get Bill Callahan in this podcast. I'm like, what do you want to talk about?
Wild Country.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more
at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.